This is XTP Media.
You're listening to Extended. Your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to this extra episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, we bring you an audio exclusive as Tim gets to speak to archivist, historian, and the curator of Boeing, Mike Lombardi. And that is, of course, to celebrate this week's centenary for Boeing, 100 years of Boeing aircraft. Let's hear what Mike has to say.
Hi there, Mike. Tim here. Thanks so much again for joining us. We've been looking forward to this all week, actually.
Oh, that's great. Well, my pleasure.
How did you end up with the world's best job of being, you know, Boeing's official archivist stroke historian?
Well, I'll tell you, the hard part was waiting 15 years for the other historian to retire. It really is a great job that combines a lot of my interests and my skills, and I'm really fortunate to have, it was a bit of luck. I studied history, that's my education. Yep. I love airplanes, and I've been with Boeing now 37 years, and 20 years as the historian, but the opportunity came up. The other historian, I'm absolutely not kidding that I was waiting for the opportunity when I started at Boeing as a very small child. I remember coming and visiting the archives and just thinking, wow, this is place I want to work.
Yeah.
All models and all that, you know, it was just amazed and said, I want to be here someday. And so when the historian retired, I interviewed for the job and must have done something right, but no, it is something that having education in history and loving aviation, it's just the perfect place. And I know every day that there's a couple thousand people waiting for me to get hit by a bus, and that does motivate me to do the best job I can.
Fantastic. So, you know, you're the size of your archive, because obviously your archive also includes the legacy companies, you know, North American, McDonnell Douglas, Rockwell, all these great names. I mean, how many documents and photos and artifacts reports
well,
have you got in it?
The archive is about seven here. There's three locations.
Yep.
And I manage I'm here at the main corporate archive, and we've got it's here in Seattle. And it's about 17,000 square feet, and it is very full. and here it is, the records of the Boeing company proper, going back to about 1910, or thereabout, about the time that Mr. Boeing had bought the properties. We have those records that when he bought the properties that he would later use to start his company. So
yeah.
Essentially what's now the famous Red Barn.
Yeah.
So that, right up to every day we're collecting records, and then also one of my personal passions for about the last 20 years has been saving the history of North American aviation, which Boeing purchased from Rockwell in 1996, and the company that made the famous P-51 Mustang and the F-86 and the T-6, the Texan,
yeah,
known as a Harvard. When it served with the RAF, so that's been my passion to save that history, and we've got a tremendous collection of records that we found in all sorts of nooks and crannies and brought together and saved that. So we've got probably 4 million photographs, the negatives actually, I'd say about 20,000 reels of motion picture film. There are, gosh, I think, see, I haven't counted lately, but that 17,000 square feet, I think we've got about 10,000 feet of it is all houses manuscript records.
Wow.
So those are old brochures and correspondence, contracts, all the typewritten and printed records.
Wow.
So it goes back to the beginning. So a wonderful collection of the history of the aerospace industry. Yeah.
How many people have you got there to kind of look over this collection or kind of manage it or work at the archive in the three locations?
There's myself, and I have one archivist here in the Puget Sound. We have one historian archivist in Los Angeles. And actually what's interesting is the greatest part of our history now because of the various mergers is in California.
Mm-hmm.
Between North American Aviation and Douglas Aircraft and Hughes.
Yep.
We actually have the largest part of our history is there. So we have a person in California. And then two have a historian and his assistant in St. Louis.
Okay. So when you sort of see these legacy companies together and you kind of track their progress with kind of brochures and how they kind of evolve, is there anything that sort of stands out in terms of their different kind of corporate cultures? I mean, obviously, your passion is North American, but these help when they come together and you look at kind of Boeing today? Does that kind of make sense that oh yes, that's from X company and that's from that's a bit of kind of Douglas DNA.
Well, that's a great question actually, and that's what there are some of the things that amaze me is how similar. Anywhere I go, that even when I read about some of the great aerospace companies there in the UK, that there's so many similarities. It's just the day-to-day lives of the folks that work here, the engineers and the machinists. But one of the things that really does stand out is how very different the cultures are in a manufacturer that builds commercial airplanes. In contrast to a manufacturer that builds strictly military airplanes, there's really a difference in culture. And that's one of the things I think that we've found that stands out the most in comparing the histories of the companies that have come together here at Boeing.
What do you think is the kind of rarest sort of item items you've got in your collection?
Well, there's so much. The things that... I think a lot of times when I hear that question, somebody wants to, see some artifact or piece of an airplane. But for me, what I think is the rarest and most captivating items that we have are the personal letters of some of these very famous people in history, or I should say in company history, and just reading their letters and seeing their handwritten notes and then thinking that these people are long gone. That to me, that is the most wonderful. It's just the immediacy of it just really brings history to life, and it helps to that with that realization that there were real people that did these amazing things throughout the last 100 years. The folks that they got up in the morning and had their breakfast, drank their coffee, came to work, and just like we do today and did these wonderful things. So it really makes that story come to life.
Sure, yeah. So, one of the things that kind of sparked off wanting to sort of talk to you, obviously it's, 100 years of Boeing this year, but when I've been around your heritage rooms in St. Louis, it's always a sort of like a fascinating going around there and sort of see the things that the models of the... the ones that got away, so to
right.
speak. The concepts that didn't make it or were cancelled a few of them with good reason. So what are your sort of top five kind of what ifs from Boeing's history of aircraft that didn't make it?
Oh, so at uh, what What are those airplanes?
Well, I'm thinking things like supersonic 2707,
like
right? The MD-12, or concepts for the 747 with double deckers or three engines.
Yeah. there are a lot of that, and what's really fascinating is that when some of the planes that we talk about today, to look back and see that those ideas were thought of it sometime in the past. That a lot of times what it's really brought home to me is that there are these brilliant people that come up with these amazing ideas, and a lot of times what we've seen is the concepts they developed were ahead of their time.
Yeah.
The customer couldn't grasp what that was or what it could be. We found not too long ago some records that in the early 1960s, engineers in Boeing Wichita were making a composite design for a small fighter plane that was a first generation stealth airplane.
Okay.
And when they and this is before the F-117 and all of this, much before that, and nobody was interested because they didn't see the need for an airplane that could avoid radar. So that's that's kind of an example. The SST is a great example of that was the greatest, most important program at Boeing in the late 1960s. Actually, in the United States, there was that friendly competition with the Concorde, and then of course in the Soviet Union with their T-144. But there was that competition to be the first to have that, and so it was very important. Wonderful airplane, but of course world events changed that, and actually worked out best for Boeing that we didn't build it and went forward with the 747 instead. Yeah. So that's an interesting piece of history. And then we go back even to another time, kind of a similar time, was just before the war. And some of the ideas that Boeing had for commercial aviation in 1939, 1940, that never came to be because of the war. And then, of course, things changed drastically. But the giant flying boats that would have dwarfed the, twice the size of the famous Boeing 314 Clipper.
Wow, okay.
Just beautiful designs like that. And
so bigger than a Spruce Goose?
It probably would have been about the close to the size of the Spruce Goose.
Whoa.
That is a big airplane. but with four decks of passengers and that sort of thing. But
wow, okay.
Yeah, and then there's a lot of concepts on the military that we see, but and then there's the competitions that the C-5 and the F-111 back in the day, and planes like the X-20, the Dinosaur, that would have had filled the role of an early space shuttle long before the space shuttle. Those sorts of things. It's just amazing to see how advanced some of these ideas are, and unfortunately ahead of their time. And I think that's kind of the lesson that comes out of that is that a lot of times the people are so smart in this industry that a lot of times they're coming up with ideas that there's just no that there's no customer yet, because there's just not haven't realized that there's a use for this. And it really goes back to Bill Boeing and his idea for the airplane. And here in of course in Europe, that was the World War One had created a use for the airplane.
Yeah,
the airplane
yeah.
was advancing quickly in Europe, but here in the United States it wasn't. And that was one of the things with Bill Boeing, is that he saw that there was a potential for the airplane that frankly in the United States most people looked at the airplane as a curiosity.
Sure.
And didn't really see a practical use. So that was one of the things that really helped Bill Boeing to found it a very successful company, is that he had that vision.
And obviously, some of these got as far as kind of mock-ups, because there was a kind of a half section of the SST
right.
The X-20. Did there was a mock-up of the X-20?
Yeah, there was a full mock-up. It's same as the pretty much like the SST, that was what they call a Class 3 mock-up. So they actually had built the airplane. It was, you know, had put actually built the structure with out of metal and such. And same with the X-20. They had built a full mock-up of it before it was canceled.
Does anything remain of those? Or were they just...
Well, the SST, actually what's interesting and a bit ironic, I think irony might be the right word, but the forward section of the SST mock-up, when the program was canceled in 1971, I don't remember who it was, but a fellow in Florida bought the mock-up and was going to make a museum, which the economy wasn't doing well, so the museum failed. And then a church took over the building, which made this very kind of dystopian image of this, you know, this SST over their main altar, the first church of supersonics or something. But then that finally the mock-up ended up in a swamp in Florida, and one of our purchased by Stan Hiller, who was a member of the board here at Boeing, but also a pioneer of helicopters.
Yeah.
All right, so he bought what was left, and sadly, a lot of it had rotted.
Yeah.
But he saved the forward section. So, from the leading edge of the wings, the forward section with the flight deck and such. So he'd saved that, put it in his museum in San Francisco. It is now been moved to acquired by the Museum of Flight here in Seattle. So
yeah,
it has made the full trip around the United States, and now it is back here with the Museum of Flight. Now, the ironic part of this is that the Museum of Flight has a Concorde, and the Concorde is now sitting next door to the building where Boeing would have built the SST. So, and the SST will be back probably sitting next to it. So that whole story has come full circle in a very interesting way.
I love the idea of the first church of supersonic flight, you know.
I think if you do a search on the internet, you might find that picture. This is the nose of the SST protruding out over the congregation.
What do you think then is the company's most sort of fascinating kind of failure or what if and why?
Well, it's hard to say. I don't, you know, there's, I've tried to look at that and say, okay, where did, you know, there's, in recent times we had our stumbles, you know, with the 787. And I think that was, you know, probably, going back, there were a few things that didn't work out, but it was, you know, that the Bill Boeing and his United aircraft and such, that was ultimately came apart in 1934. But I think that one of the greatest challenges we've really faced is this recent one with the 787. And I think that you know, the biggest problem there was, like you mentioned earlier, was these different cultures.
Yeah.
And right on the heels of a merger and trying to bring together these different cultures to embark on a whole brand new airplane program and then a whole new system of designing and building an airplane, it was a lot to do.
Yeah.
And that was quite a challenge. So that whole episode is something that's been well studied within the Boeing company, and all of those issues that we went through have been analyzed so that we learn from those things. And I was going to say that, you know, while I think that whole episode, you know, and we all know it because it was in the press so much, that with the battery and the issues with suppliers and such, that it was really interesting to see that you know, this was a tremendously difficult period, that there were days, and I know a lot of people felt that maybe this we wouldn't be able to do this. There were some, especially outside of Boeing, I know there were a lot of people, but inside Boeing, what was fascinating was that you had all these people that just believed that it would get fixed, it would be done.
Yeah.
That we do impossible things with, that we've been through hard times in the past, you know, with the SST shutting down and that whole bit. that we would overcome this, and they firmly believed that. And it was, for me, so wonderful to see that spirit. You know, Bill Boeing said that to not let any new idea go by saying it can't be done. And he also said that hard work and science can lick any problem. And to see that here we are, all these years later, and people still believe that it really is ingrained in Boeing. And I do think that what we went through probably would have put any other company out of business.
Right. Okay.
It really was, I think, one of Boeing's finest moments that we overcame that. Now, you look at that 787, it's a beautiful airplane. It's a fitting addition to this amazing family of airplanes that have made history for 100 years. And it's doing amazing things. It introduced all of these technologies that make flying more comfortable, and it's just a beautiful airplane. So I think that was one of our toughest moments. And I think that the breakup in 1934, when Bill Boeing had probably one of the largest corporations in America, he really was kind of the Bill Gates of his day, with this very successful company that combined the manufacture of airplanes and engines with an airline that was the first to establish a transcontinental air route across the United States, and then to have that broken up was quite difficult. And then the Boeing company was part of this great holding company and had all that security of being a subsidiary of this corporation, and now they have this small company on its own again and had to reinvent itself. Those were very hard times. But that's when the B-17 was introduced, and that's the airplane that really started over again and saved the company.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. You know, obviously bad at the time for him, but the world owes a debt of gratitude to have made the decision, because then you might not have had, you know, if it gone in a different direction and concentrated on kind of airline operations, you know.
Right.
Would you have had the B-17? Would you have the B-29? Would you have the 707, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, and you're absolutely right. I think that you can draw a line, and that's where I often do. I go to that point, and because at that time, of course, Douglas had captured the commercial airplane market, and with the DC-3, and so Boeing was out of that, and Boeing was a major player in that market up until that point. The other market that Boeing was a big player in was building fighter planes, the F-4B, the P-12. These were some of the world's best fighter planes, but all of the companies in the United States were building fighters, so it was very competitive. So really, the only place to go was to build big airplanes. And Boeing had been developing the technologies in the early 1930s to build big metal airplanes. And so that was a conscious decision made by Claire Egvet, who was the CEO of the company that after the breakup. And that was a decision that we still follow today. That's our main business is building big airplanes. And so that was a... And from that B-17, which saved Boeing, but also went on to be this, you know, the famous airplane that in World War II. But here in the United States, the airplane helped our war planners, our military, and our politicians to understand what the theory of air power really was.
Sure,
This airplane helped them to understand that, and it then established what America's wartime strategy was, which was air power, and that was all based on the capability of the B-17, which then led to the B-29, and then after the war, there was of course the B-47, B-52, and the whole swept discovery of the swept wing and the potted engine, and that led to the 707, which led to what we do today. So it is kind of a single thread.
Fantastic. Yeah. Maybe we've covered this a little bit, but obviously, Boeing was obviously said to bet the farm on the 747. Do you think there's any other sort of like projects where it was a kind of a must win or, you know, kind of complete gambles? I mean, you've sort of said that obviously 787 may have, you know, called any other company to kind of go under, but were there any other sort of periods where you look back and you kind of, you know, maybe from a kind of company newsletters where, hang on, this was quite a kind of a risky move at that time?
Well, and I think that really is what characterizes Boeing, and you know, people say what has made Boeing, you know, why is Boeing still here after 100 years, and that's really it, is that willingness to take that risk to bet the company. And that was, there were several instances of that, you know, that, you know, 1927, Bill Boeing decided to jump into the airline business. That was tremendously risky, and that proved to be very successful. Then in 1934, the B-17 was a tremendous risk. You know, the company had, Boeing built the prototype with the company's own funds, and then the prototype crashed, and Boeing was out of the competition. Boeing had lost the competition based on that. There was nothing, but because they took the risk to make a very innovative and very forward-looking airplane, it became a must-have airplane, which saved the company. Boeing took another huge risk with the B-47, the radical concept of making it a swept-wing jet and hanging the engines off of the wings in pods. That was completely unheard of and very risky, but it was such a great performer that it became the airplane that the Air Force had to have, and established the basic design for all the jets that Boeing and Airbus builds today. And then following that, the decision to build the Dash 80, the prototype for the 707, Boeing had no customers showing any interest in a jet transport, and in an invite, think about it. The commercial jet business was, you know, of course, the Comet had come out early, and but it had those very dramatic, catastrophic accidents, and was grounded, and with that, there was a reputation that jets weren't safe.
Yeah,
and the airlines were very happy with their Douglas prop liners and their Lockheed Constellations. There was no market for that, and yet they made that conscious decision, saying that the future is going to be a jet transport. So we're going to build one and make everybody believe that. So they defined the future by doing that. And then when that 707 first was announced, and Douglas came back with the DC-8, there was this vision of the 240s, Model 247, DC-3 or DC-2 competition was all coming back, and so Boeing had to take another risk of completely redesigning that 707 to make it better than the DCA.
Yeah.
And so those were all, you know, and then of course you have the 747, which you mentioned. Those were all tremendous risks. Those were all bet the company moments. And that really is kind of what has kept Boeing in business and set it apart from other companies, is that willingness to take those calculated risks. It's a reflection of the leadership. You have leaders who, starting with Bill Boeing, who could judge good people, would bring good people in the company, and then trust those people to make good decisions and give good counsel.
Yeah.
And so Boeing has been very blessed with good leadership, with good engineering, and just really talented people across the board that have made this company a success.
From across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures, and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
I think it's fascinating that you know, we obviously in Europe, you know, or the UK at least, you know, you kind of think, well, the Comet and the Dash 8 and you know, what could have been. I think it's interesting you said, you know, the reputation then of the Comet had put people off, you know, jets full stop. And also the B-47 with the sort of swept wing technology, which the US and the US and the UK were scouring Germany for the scientists and aerospace
right.
technology after World War II. And you know, from what I, mainly from my reading of it, is that the You know, the US ended up with the rocket scientists, and we had the aerodynamicists. And yet, it was the, you know, it's the you guys that exploited the swept wing and to the full.
Right. Well, and that's why, you know, in my opinion, that the B-47 is it's really not recognized for what it did, and I think it's probably, and I've argued this with some of our folks even at the Smithsonian here, that I think it's the second most important airplane in history, at least here in the United States, behind the Wright Flyer, because of, you know, what we're talking here is that, and it wasn't that we brought the German scientists here. It's that one of our aerodynamicists, George Shire, went to Germany as part of the study mission after the war and found the swept wing, and then Boeing had made all of the right decisions to adapt that technology quickly. They had taken another risk, another huge financial risk in building, the company had its own wind tunnel, which at the time, before World War II, was a rarity. Most of the universities had wind tunnels, and that's where the various companies would go to test. So Boeing understood that it had to have its own wind tunnel. And a lot of that was based on the counsel of famous test pilot Eddie Allen, and as well as the counsel of the famous aerodynamicist Theodore von Karman. Both of them were really adamant that Boeing should make a wind tunnel and make a high-speed wind tunnel, which was so fortuitous when George Shire sent back from Germany these notes, which we still have, which are a great treasure, but these notes about the swept wing and about how to apply that, they were able to test it immediately and found that it worked. But the other key element, which to the story, is that the you know, the conventional design for an airplane at that time was that the engines would always be on the wing.
Yeah.
Right? You know, the propeller-driven airplanes, the B-17s and the Lancasters and such, they all had those engines protruding out the front of the wings. And so when you sweep the wing back, you really can't do that. It takes away from the performance of the airfoil. So the challenge was, where do you put the engines? And that, the very clever discovery made by probably our greatest engineer at Boeing, Ed Wells, came up with the concept of hanging the engines off the wing in pods on strut. And, of course, they discovered that worked. And with that discovery, putting together the swept wings and those engines, they had invented the basic design for the large jet that we still follow today, that Airbus still follows today.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, it was a really important discovery.
Fantastic. Well, that's B-47 should get a bigger slice of the glory then.
Well, that's my humble opinion.
I think we've also the next question. I think we're on the list. I think we also covered a little bit with this composite sort of stealth fighter thing. Which I'm hoping. Are there any pictures there or diagrams of this?
I can. There was a fellow who wrote a story on it not too long ago, but I can send you some things on that.
That would really be fantastic.
He had discovered that Boeing had actually made a patent sometime later. And he discovered that doing the search and then came to me and said, what have you got on this? So,
excellent. So then on to the next one. What is perhaps the one fact that, you know, you can surprise, you know, kind of veteran kind of company employees or executives, senior executives, when they come around and visit you at the archive? Is there anything that kind of you can kind of pull out and their jaws drop?
Oh, let's see. Gosh, there's... You know, I make up so many things in that I can't recall them all. gosh, there's so many things that it's kind of, you know, the wonderful stories of the company. You know, I think the one that really astounds people, you know, we go to back to World War II, and of course, a lot of what, you know, Boeing is, we manufacture airplanes, so a lot of, you know, that as an enthusiast, a lot of us look at the finished product and we focus on, you know, the finished airplanes and, you know, how high does it fly, how fast does it go, what is it? But one of the biggest part of really our story is how do we build those airplanes? And so a lot of what I found to be interesting and a lot of what I do is helping that, you know, supporting the manufacturing and telling that story of of how we fabricate and assemble airplanes. So going back to World War II, the fascinating story is how did Boeing and other manufacturers as well, but how did we build these airplanes in these just astounding numbers? And the one, I think, statistic that is just amazing, because especially today we're talking about ramping up our 737 production to these really amazing numbers. And I point out to people that in Renton, where we build the 737,
yep.
The Renton plant was started, well, it actually became part of Boeing to build the B-29. So now the B-29 was, and this is one of the things a lot of people don't realize, it was the most expensive program in World War II, the most intensive and important program in World War II, and this is even taking into consideration the Manhattan Project to build the atom bomb.
Yeah.
Because the atom bomb wasn't going anywhere without an airplane to carry it. So the B-29 was very important. The airplane was arguably the most technologically advanced airplane of its time. Very complex. And so Boeing developed a really complex and efficient system to build the airplane. And with that system that involved having finished assemblies, completely finished assemblies, built off-site, driven to the plant, put on rails, they were moved around the factory on a moving line, and the airplanes were plugged together and pushed out the door, which is a lot like how we build the 787 today. But with that, with this very advanced airplane, which would be like building B-2 bombers today, they were able to build, they went, the rate of production when they started in Renton January of 1944, they delivered two airplanes that month. And just the following year, in July of 1945, the rate was up to 160 airplanes a month. They could build five of them in a day.
Oof.
So, and then, across the way in Seattle, the record for building B-17s, they built 15 in one day.
Well,
so that, those are kind of the, I think those are kind of the gee whiz numbers that
incredible.
Get people's attention.
Yeah, it certainly is. Yeah. That's amazing. So, I mean, just thinking, you know, you've alluded to kind of, you know, sort of assembling sub 787s and similar to B-29. How useful is your archive to your current engineers and your marketers and your test pilots and
right.
people working on current and future problems? Does it get much use of people coming in and saying, you know, I've got a really tricky problem here with, undercarriage, or how did someone solve this, or,
right.
you know, we need...
Well, that's exactly what I see as the primary use for what we do. One of the things is that one of the biggest challenges I have is making sure that history is relevant. That this is a corporation, and all the parts of it need to contribute to the bottom line. It's just not, we can't just have an archive that's a collection of our treasures that we roll out. Whenever there's a centennial, for example, that every day we've got to contribute, we've got to provide value to the corporation. And so that's my biggest challenge. So the ways that we do that, I mean, history has to work for the company, and you've hit it on the head that I bring our engineers in here and say, here is the collective knowledge of all those brilliant engineers that came before you. So don't reinvent the wheel. Take this knowledge and build on it. And so they do come here and just like you said, okay, I have this problem. How did we know that in the past? So for an example, you know, you've heard this secret space plane that's orbiting the Earth right now, right? This X plane that Boeing built that the Air Force has orbiting in space. It's always in the news because it's been up there for a year, what have you.
Yeah.
In designing and building that, and its predecessors, one of the challenges was that there was before reentry, they have to have all the fuel out of the vehicle and such, and they couldn't figure out how to do one part of that, and I can't get too specific, but they came here and said, you know, when North American built the X-15 rocket plane, they had solved this problem. They had obviously solved it. So what did they do? And so they went back and looked at the X-15 to support one of the design issues they were having with that. When we famously, back in the late 90s, Boeing came out with that really interesting design for the Sonic Cruiser.
Yep.
And so that was very different from the jets that we built, kind of like the SST, but we hadn't really built an airplane with the canards, you know, the little airfoils on the front of the airplane. And so they were, so our designers weren't sure how to do all of the mechanisms, the hydraulics and such, to make that work, and how those structures should be designed. So they came here and said, you know, that North American had built the XB-70 that was very similar.
Yep.
And so we used those drawings and information to support that. The Phantom I, this large UAV that Boeing has been testing, is largely based on an airplane called the Condor that Boeing made in the late 80s. So going back to the structures and design philosophies and the testing on that, you know, these sorts of things have saved our engineers months and months of work and millions of dollars. So those are a couple of things that, and I constantly encourage our engineers to not only contribute, you know, come down and use this, but to contribute their knowledge, to continue to build this base of company knowledge. So that's what I feel that's our main use. The other thing is, like, just some of the things that we've been talking about is that that Boeing has a very unique culture that has made the company a success over 100 years. And so I think a big part of what my job is to understand what that culture is.
Yep.
And to pass it on, to make sure that gets passed on, that this whole idea that, you know, these things like, you know, the work we do here is incredibly hard. It is very difficult. And for some people, they feel that what we do is sometimes said to be impossible. But that's what we do.
Yeah.
And so those kind of ideas and to tell those stories, to reinforce that with the new generation of employees, to make sure that DNA and that culture is handed down, to ensure that the Boeing company will be here for at least another 100 years. I think that's a really important part of what I do.
So where does this material come from? I mean, is presumably, obviously, it's generated already, and you know through mergers and stuff. But
right.
Are people donating kind of private collections and photos?
Yeah.
And, is there also some sort of, you know, bits that you're kind of missing, and you're thinking, well, you know, maybe this will turn up one day on eBay?
Goodness gracious, eBay. It's been a blessing and a curse. But we do have some policies and procedures within the company to collect records and such. So a lot of what we do, it gets here kind of automatically based on procedures we've set in place. But we do get some of the great treasures do come from our retired employees. A lot of engineers who've worked here for decades, they collect a lot of interesting artifacts and treasures and papers just from their day-to-day work that, you know, for them, it's their work. They don't have a concept that it's this amazing piece of aviation history. But at some point, they have to downsize their homes and such, and then that material will come here. Interestingly enough, one of the collections that we just picked up 2 years ago were the personal papers of Bill Boeing himself. His son, Bill Jr., had kept all these papers at his personal residence, and finally decided that it needed to come to the archive. So after decades and decades of time, that collection finally arrived. That was a wonderful collection to have.
Wow.
Well, for example, with North American Aviation, the company never had an archive, but there were records stored in places all over the country, and we were able to, it's a bit of industrial archaeology, they call it, but just doing this investigating and going through records management and talking to retirees and such, we located collections in various places and brought them together. So it's a great bit of work, and it's fascinating. It's a lot of detective work. It's a bit of Indiana Jones, which it makes it very interesting. But there are those things that we just we haven't been able to find, and like I say, the eBay things, and in particular right now, Howard Hughes's his aviation empire has been dispersed, and we're still trying to locate that. So that's one of the things we've been looking for. As far as corporate genealogy, we are the inheritors of the parts of his company that made his famous airplanes, like the H-1 Racer, and the Hercules or the Spruce Goose. So we have none of those records on those planes, and so that's one of the things that we're looking for.
So
there's those treasures out there, and we always hear these stories of at one time some company opened up the doors and told people come in, take all the wind tunnel models and go, you always hear these stories of things going into they're just going to the rubbish bin, and that's what I tell people. I say all of aviation history originated in the trash somewhere. There's so many stories of very brave people going through these giant rubbish piles and pulling together records and photographs that were thrown out and saving those. So it is a sad thing, but there are enough people that care about this to know its value that we've really been able to bring together a wonderful collection.
And obviously, 100 years anniversary this year. So, one of the things I've noticed is there's been a kind of a drive to collect people's personal stories of Boeing history. What's some of the sort of the most amazing tales you've heard from kind of past employees or kind of people who've flown your aircraft?
Oh, gosh. Well, the things that always amaze me is it's the stories you don't ever hear. The things that are never written down.
Yeah.
And that's why that is the most important type of history, is to get those interviews and those personal notes. Because, for example, our salespeople, there's such a wonderful story to tell there. I think you could make several great adventure movies about what these airplane salesmen go through, and I'm sure that it'd be true for the Airbus folks as well. But going back to the 1950s, I hear stories from Boeing was a military airplane company, and with B-52s and KC-135s and such, and so all of our engineers were used to going to Air Force bases and work with them, and all of a sudden the company is now trying to work with airlines, and so these engineers who are used to working with Air Force people are now going to airlines in all parts of the world and have no idea of how to do any of this, and their stories of just starting from scratch, going to these these third world countries to sell airplanes and being shot at by rebels or eating bad food or dealing with finding themselves in some risky places and things. It's just it's really amazing but that's the thing, you just don't see those in the newspapers or the official documents. Those are the only place you're ever going to hear those things, or the test pilots you can read about a particular flight test and it'll say something like, at this point, this anomaly happened, and then that's it. But when you talk to them and get their, there was this loud bang and the plane did this and so those are the things that they're just, they're priceless and they're just wonderful pieces of history. So.
Amazing. How do you guys cope with the sort of digitization efforts and the fact that some of these things are 35mm film or VHS, who uses VHS these days,
right.
Laserdisc, all kind of previous kind of formats where
Right.
If an engineer comes in and says, there is something I want to see on, you know, if it's on a floppy disk, how do I see it?
Yeah. Well, that's right there. You've just hit our biggest challenge. There's two sides of that. There's the part of, what do we do with the present collection, which, like you're saying, is in all these different formats. Whether it's 16 millimeter film or it's on, like you say, on a floppy disk or what have you. So we've got these dozens and dozens of different formats, and it's just really complex. And I think that's what the real great challenge of archiving is these days, is how to keep up with that and keep it from deteriorating. What are the decisions and the strategies about moving that to a digital platform, and then what do you do with the originals? Those are all questions that we're wrestling with. But the other one the really great challenge now is collecting what we call born digital records. Everything today is a digital record.
Yeah.
It isn't on paper anymore. Drawings are done on CATIA and such. And so how do we capture that? And the additional, probably the biggest problem we have is volume.
Yeah.
Because digital records are so easy to create, we create a lot of them. And in the past, when somebody would write a letter, it would take a lot of time and effort to write a letter. So it was always something that was meaningful. And so when we have correspondence, files of letters, all those letters have some important information. Well, now with email, 90% of our notes on email are just, they're meaningless.
Cat videos.
And, yeah, so they're it's just doo-doo, as they say, the professional term. And so how do you weed through that and capture those important nuggets while getting rid of that huge volume of extraneous, those things you don't need at all? So that's really the big challenge.
So you're so also saving things like, kind of Boeing's web pages that get updated and the Farnborough microsite or the Paris Air Show microsite and things like that.
Right, right. Those are all, if you can reframe the question to be, Mike, what keeps you awake at night? And this would be the answer I would give you. So, yeah, it's a tremendous challenge, and it's the biggest challenge that we're facing right now in trying to we're creating a plan to deal with this in the future, and because it is such a big issue. It is an issue throughout the entire world of archiving.
Yeah.
That really from the beginning of the internet and up until right about now, there's going to be a period that future historians will call it a digital dark age, where we really because we didn't have a strategy to capture history, we've really lost a lot of it. You think about the motion pictures and television and the news and such, all of this was captured digitally, and none of it was saved, and
yeah.
So there are going to be great lapses of our history throughout the late 90s and the first part of the century. So that it's a big problem that all of us in the archive and the history world are tackling right now.
Yeah, the archive not open to the public, but you must bring many requests from the authors, media, filmmakers, etc., to kind of delve into.
Oh yeah,
can you say something about that? And what's perhaps the oddest request?
Well, there's there's always those odd requests about alien artifacts. yeah, so there's. I'll leave it at that. But when I was a kid, I think I was born an aviation nut, and so as a young person, I would write letters to NASA. I would write letters to the airplane manufacturers and ask for pictures.
Yeah.
And one of the things that really hits home for me is that I wrote a letter to Boeing and received this wonderful package of photographs and a nice note from the historian Harl Bracken, who is now my predecessor. So now I'm the person sending out pictures and letters to these to young people, and so having that memory of how important that what that meant to me, it's something that's very that I think it's so vital, because it helps, you know, that this can get rather mundane, and a lot of these questions can pile up, but I always remember that, you know, when I was a child, that how much that meant to me, and that. And so I always think of that when I get a note from a young person.
Yeah.
And plus, I want to infect as many young people I can with the aviation bug. And so I feel I'm doing my part to keep spreading that disease and keeping young people interested in the aerospace industry. And I think that's really important. So I do. As often as I can, I try to help students and, you know, young people who are building models or creating something for a flight simulator, what have you, and authors. There are still a lot of good authors out there, and I love to help them, because I want to continue to see good aviation books printed and such. So we do. I help the public when I can.
I think it's wonderful, Mike, that you've still got young people, you know, getting in touch, wanting to kind of contact you directly, rather than just kind of, you know, kind of hoovering up the stuff off the web and you know, I'll go to Wikipedia and, oh, there's a picture of something. You know, that there are young people who you know want to get it from the, you know, this information or want help from the, you know, from the motherload, as it were. You know.
Right. Well, I think that's one of why it's really important that I do, you know, kind of reward that initiative by doing as much as I can to help those researchers out. Because you're absolutely right. If a young person is going to be astute enough and do as much work and research to contact an archive and go to the source, I think that rather, like you say, rather than relying on the pretty sketchy information on Wikipedia. That I think that should be rewarded, and so I do always do what I can to try to help out.
Okay, so almost about to wrap up now, but so obviously we're selling our 150th anniversary this year, and we've got a big archive, which I'm sure you're aware of, in the NAL, Farnborough National Aerospace Library. You know, obviously squeezed budgets and, you know, more and more information being online. How important is it to kind of fund and maintain this historic archives? I mean, we've kind of gone on that sort of a touch on that a little bit already of, you know, helping to inspire the young, and also, you know, engineers coming to you with problems and, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, and don't reinvent the wheel. So can you say something about that?
Well, I think those are all really important, and one of the things that I think is also really important about, you know, this is the original, these are the original documents. So what you see on the internet, what's written in books, it's all, that's secondary, or maybe even tertiary. It's not the original. So here, this is the raw material where all of that comes from. So if you want to get the absolute the accuracy, then this is what you need to do. But the other side of that is what I found to be really important, because the subject comes up that all of this material can just be put into a warehouse and we can have somebody who just pulls it out and sends it. But, you know, it's kind of the same thing libraries are going through, that you can just pull a book off the internet or buy it from Amazon. But, you know, having a librarian who you can walk into the library and say, you know, I'm not quite sure what book I'm looking for, but here's, you know, what I'm thinking about. And having that person that has that experience to say, I know what you mean, and here's where you need to go.
Yeah.
That's what we're missing. And that's what's so, I think, different about what we do here, is that it's not just a collection. You know, I don't call this the Boeing Archives. Like, we call it the Boeing, it's a history program. And it's not just about keeping these records. It's about having, you know, we have this handful of historians who can interpret it.
Yeah.
You know, part of what I do is that I can understand an engineer, I can understand a test pilot, and I can then interpret that to say, here's what I think you need, here's what's going to help you. And you're not going to find that just searching through something on the computer.
Yeah.
You really need that experience, and so I think that's that's a really important part of this that I think gets missed, is that you need good historians, and libraries need good librarians that can help researchers, and I think that's one of the things that we lose. And I think a lot of times you see some really when people put things together, whether it's a book or some sort of article, I see that, you know, they've done some really poor research. And I think that's one of the reasons, is that they just rely on what they find on the internet.
Yeah, and don't ask any experts. Yeah, brilliant.
So,
fantastic. Just really, really great to talk to you, Mike.
My pleasure. Like I said, anytime I can talk about airplanes or keeping history, you know, I enjoy that. So.
And, you know, next time I'm in Seattle, I must come over and sort of meet you in person and have a look at the, you know, I've obviously been to the kind of heritage rooms and had a look around there. Those have been a sort of place where I've had to be kind of dragged out of back in.
Do send me a note and plan we'll give you a tour of the archives. And then the other thing to be aware of, too, is that have you been to Seattle?
Yes.
Okay, so have you been to the Museum of Flight?
Yes.
Okay, so the Museum of Flight is, in a way, it's an extension of what I do here, my predecessor and some other very aviation-minded Boeing employees started that because I can't keep full airplane. I don't have enough room in my archives for a 747 and such, so we needed a place to put the large artifacts. And so really, even though the Museum of Flight is a private museum and separate from Boeing, it was started by my predecessors and Boeing employees to keep those large artifacts. So it is an extension of what we do here.
Yeah.
So it's a great collection there. And a lot of the materials that we've saved, some of the better items, we put on display at the Museum of Flight. So when you go there, you're actually seeing an extension of what we do here.
Oh, that's a fantastic place to visit, you know. So
it's wonderful. Yeah.
Thanks so much for your time.
Take care now.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed that very special episode and the intriguing discussion that Mike had with Tim. Remember to look us up on Facebook and Twitter, Aviation Extended, or one word, no leading E on Extended. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. And remember, stay tuned to this frequency, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extend it.
This is XTP Media.